Staten Island mother, two boys, Connor and Brandon, age 4 and 2. Her Ford Explorer stalled in the middle of the street right as the storm surge was hitting, and she knew the car was going to head out to sea. She grabbed her boys. She tried to get to safety. She held on as the water came, as the flood came. She held on for dear life to her two little boys, but she wasn't strong enough. And the flood came, and her two children were washed out to sea. It's something I see in parents sometimes when their kids are getting ready to head off to college, and they wonder, they're going to head away from home, they're going to be away from their church, they're going to be away from youth group, they're going to be away from all those dozens, those scores of Christian men and women who taught their kids and prayed for their kids and talked to their kids after church and who were involved, that safety net, and they wonder what's going to happen to their kids. Are their kids going to be washed away? I'm not an expert in parenting. I have two cats. But I have been in one place for over 20 years, and there are kids who are getting ready to graduate from college who I was here sitting in one of those pews where you are when Pastor George baptized them, and I was one of the people who said, "We will. We will help." And so I've been able to see some things, and we're going to turn to the Gospel of Matthew to see, more importantly, what Jesus says about parenting. There are a number of times he talks about children. But one of the most obvious is one that we miss because we miss the context culturally in which he spoke it. It's Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 through 29, as Jesus talks about your house. And in the ancient world, your house meant more than the structure. It was also a symbol for your family. Whether you're talking about, 19th century, the fall of the house of Usher, it's not just the building, it's the whole family. The house of Herod, the Herodians, your house, your family. What are you building it on? And what's going to keep your children when the flood comes, and the flood always comes, when the flood comes, what's the only thing that can keep them from being washed out to sea? Matthew 7 in your pew Bible, it's page 1506, Matthew chapter 7 beginning in verse 24, Jesus is speaking. "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand, and the rain came down, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as the teachers of the law. This is one of the most misunderstood passages in the Bible, because we, from our secular perspective, where Christians are often fighting culture wars against people who don't care about right and wrong, we read this and we read rock as the Bible. Jesus is saying, don't build your house on the world's sand, doing whatever you feel like. Build it on the Bible, the rock. But Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, these last three chapters, has been contrasting two things: the religious legalism of the Pharisees and building your life on Jesus and his gospel. "You have heard it said, but I say unto you, if you really understood that you have a Father in heaven who truly delights in you, who already knows what you need before you ask it." He's been contrasting the religion of the Pharisees with living your life on the gospel. The rock is not the religion of the Pharisees. The rock is not all of the rules and regulations and the attempts to control your kids through technique and various efforts in order to get them to please God. That's the sand. And Jesus is saying, if you build your family on that, the flood will come and your children and your whole household will be washed out to sea. Because that doesn't work. He says, build your house on the rock. Build your house on Jesus. Jesus is the chief cornerstone. He is the stumbling stone. He is the foundation stone on which the church is built. And He is the rock. His unconditional love and acceptance, the fact that He took all of your sins and all of your kids' sins on Himself and let them crush Him, and He gives you and your kids His righteousness. He spent 30 years, 33 years, living the perfect life, and He unzips that clothing, and He takes it, and He puts it on you, and He puts it on your kids, and covers them with an unremovable suit of forgiveness and righteousness. He says, when you build your life on that, the flood's still going to come. It's going to be hard, but you're going to stand because you've built your life not on what you do for God, that's sand, but what Jesus did for you. Really just got one point today, but I'll call it 3 points just because it's a sermon and it's a Presbyterian church and there's supposed to be three, but the first one's going to be 20 minutes and the others are tack-ons. What is the Bible's message about parenting? First big point, the big point. It is not about technique. It is about the gospel and having a gospel culture in your home. We tend to stress technique. I see young parents, and they were doing it 20 years ago, and they're doing it today, really stressing over, am I feeding my child the right things? Am I supposed to feed my child when they're hungry, when they're crying, or on demand, or am I supposed to feed them in structured feedings? Am I supposed to, let my child cry through the night, or am I supposed to get up every time they cry? Am I supposed to do this? Am I supposed to do that? Am I supposed to Christian school or homeschool or private school or public school? Am I, all of these things we get really, really worked up over. Is there corn syrup in my waffles? Do I spank or do I use timeouts? And all of these are valid concerns. I am not making light of these. These are the kinds of things. When I got cats, I spent hours just Googling what the perfect food was for a Toyger. I can't imagine the amount of effort that you put into figuring this stuff out. And I don't really have any opinions about it. But I'll tell you, that's really not the heart of parenting. Dan Allender says that of children born and raised in evangelical, gospel-centered churches, churches that actually hold on to Christian orthodoxy, of those kids, 17% of them go to an evangelical church in adulthood. 83% are washed away. You go into Christian bookstores the last recent decades, all sorts of parenting books giving you all sorts of techniques, 83% washed away, folks. It is not working. It's not working. It's not about technique. Even thinking, okay, so let's raise kids God's way can trip us up because you and I are idol factories, John Calvin says. And once we then start saying, I'm going to do it God's way, then I'm going to amass, 500 biblical principles that if I follow these biblical principles, God will bless me. God will bless my kids. No, He won't. Because that's the sand. That's the religion of the Pharisees. Yes, biblical principles are there, but the heart of it is Jesus. The heart of it is the gospel. Paul asks the Galatians, having begun by the Spirit, are you now trying to become perfect through human effort? Techniques, they can get outward appearance of health, but they don't address the heart. Jeff Van Vonderen speaks often at schools on the topic of drug and alcohol abuse. Often he speaks to the parents, and he says this. He says it gets people upset, but he says, just because you have somehow gotten your child to stop using drugs and alcohol, and instead they're now playing football and are in band, does not necessarily mean that you have a healthy child. He gives an example of a child named David. Child is empty and needy on the inside. David is prone to seek approval from those around him. And so he gets involved with the wrong crowd, and he's living to please them because inwardly he's needy, inwardly he's empty. And so he does what they want him to do, and he starts making all sorts of bad choices, the drugs, the alcohol, the language, you name it. He's into all sorts of trouble with the law. And he's empty on the inside, and he looks like he's empty on the inside because emptiness in a crowd is still emptiness. And a religious family, a churched family, may try then every effort to control or coerce little David into changing. They'll offer threats. You know, I'll send you to a Christian school if you keep doing this. Like, that should be punishment. If it happens again, you're off the football team. If you keep going down this path, God's going to punish you, David. So now let's say David begins to make the turnaround that his churched family desperately longs for. He joins the church youth group. He starts coming to church regularly. He starts reading all the good books. He starts listening to Christian music. He gets rid of his bad CDs that were obviously the problem. And yet the reality is he's still empty on the inside. And he's still looking for love and acceptance from those around him. It's just now he's in a church context, and so he's looking for love and acceptance from churched people. And so he's doing the kinds of things that churched people will be pleased with. And the reality is that David is on a performance treadmill, and he is trying to purchase the approval of his church and his family through his behavior. It's works righteousness, trying to make himself whole by pleasing them. And yet the reality is he's still empty on the inside. He pleases the socks off his parents and grandparents and teacher and pastor. He goes along with the regimen. But the more performance-oriented they are, the more pleased they are. And his positive performance earns their approval, even though they don't think of it that way. So here's the question for you. Which David was healthier? The first David, hanging out with the wrong crowd, doing things that are honestly going to damage his health. Or the second David, sitting in church, going to church, being in youth group, doing all the right things. The first one was empty on the inside, and he was living for people's approval. The second David was empty on the inside, and he was living for people's approval. The first one, it was obvious. The second one, it was hidden, and he had the appearance of health. The reality is that the first David was unhealthy, and the second David was unhealthy too. See, no amount of religious control was able to address those heart issues, those deep issues that every child has. Every child's biggest battle from the womb onward is the same as every Christian's biggest battle from the womb onward. And that is to find your significance, your identity, your value, not in what you do, but in what Jesus Christ did for you fully, finally, and forever. To know that you are loved, that you have absolute validation. Because if you don't have that from Jesus, you're going to look for that from other people, and it's going to crush you, and you're going to be crushingly empty on the inside. Jesus talks about streams of living water, if you believe him. Streams of living water will flow up from inside of you. That's what will set David free. That's what will set any child free, is when the gospel is welling up inside of them so massively, so freely, giving them a sense of significance, meeting their deepest needs, making them whole and complete inside so that they can begin learning outwardly to walk in accordance with Christ. What forms a gospel culture in the home? You know, if that's the rock, if Jesus is the rock that alone can keep us from being swept away, if, as Dan Doriani says, parenting is just big sinners helping little sinners see Jesus, then the question is, what culture do you have in your family? If you're not married, with your roommates, with your friends, with your coworkers, because this applies to all of us in different ways, what's the culture? If somebody were to stay in your home for a week and you were not to try to please them and were not to try to do the performance treadmill thing of earning their favor by being good, if you were just to be yourself, your normal family life for a week, at the end of that week when that guest leaves, what are they going to say about your household? Are they going to talk about Jesus? Are they going to say, gosh, that family loves sinners? I have never seen such love and acceptance. Gosh, those kids can be totally honest about how bad they are, and mom and dad are totally honest about how bad they are, and they just seem to love each other more and more. Wow, this is gospel everywhere. Jesus is all over that household. They really know that they have a Father in heaven who's wild about them. Those kids are so confident, so joyful. Gosh, they have such intimacy with their family because it's so safe. They know they are loved. You know, what's God's power to save? It's the gospel. And children learn
to walk with God. They learn the gospel very often the same way that if you're an American raised in the United States, it's the same way you learn to speak English. You didn't learn to speak English in school. School is where they corrected the way you speak English, but you learned to speak English by immersion, by being around it. It was the air you breathe. It was the environment you're in. And when a mom and a dad really get the gospel in a deep way and it captivates their heart, the children catch that. It's caught before it's taught. And there's a security in a life that's amazing. I'll tell you some stories. Some bad, some good. First, I'll tell you a story about an 18-year-old woman who was dating a 40-year-old man, and it was an abusive relationship. He hit her. And later on, she was a 25-year-old, and she was dating a different guy who was 50 years old, double her age, also an abusive relationship. And a counselor spoke with her, heard her story. Her dad had died when she was a little girl. Her mom had live-in boyfriends who had abused her. It was bad. And what was she looking for in all these relationships? She was looking for daddy. She was looking for a father who would love her unconditionally, who would accept her and approve of her, who would be those eyes saying, "You measure up, you're good enough." A home saturated with the gospel is a home that's filled with unconditional love, affirmation, praise freely given, because that's what your Father in heaven gives to you. He delights in you. He's pleased with you. It's a gospel culture. What are some steps? Obviously, being in a church yourself helps. In a church of people that are changed by the gospel, who have been set free by it, who have joy, who are honest about their brokenness, and yet even more honest about the power of Jesus and his delight in them. Church of people who are really excited about Jesus, who are excited about the gospel. A gospel culture in a church can help you learn gospel culture in your family. And yet learning yourself to be thirsty for grace, thirsty for Christ. I remember one church where one of the parents in the youth group walked in before youth group, and the word unconditional love was on the board, and they had talked about that for several weeks, and she goes up to the youth pastor. She's like, "Youth pastor, I'm sorry. My kids don't need more gospel. It's been gospel, 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 grace, grace, grace. My kids need the rules. They need to know the law. They need to know what's forbidden. They need somebody to actually make them do the right thing." And how's that going for you? I've been here 20 years. I've seen those families. And without exception, their kids all go wild because they've never learned unconditional acceptance and love. They've never been safe to be broken. They've always had to hide their sin from their parents. They can't be honest because it's not safe, because the gospel is not at the center of that household. Maybe mom and dad were believers. Maybe the kids were believers, but they never had gospel love. "It's sand," Jesus says. "It's sand, and your kids are going to be washed away, and I've been here long enough to watch it untold times." It's the grace of God that teaches us to say no to ungodliness. Paul says of religious, human, man-made rules, he says, they have an appearance of wisdom, but they are of no value in restraining sensual indulgence. Colossians 2, look it up. No value. Only the gospel can do that. Only the gospel can deal with the stuff inside that can actually work its way outside. I remember one family learning this, a young family, couple kids, and they'd had a situation where the painter on their house, painting the outside of their house, getting ready for sale, had been pretty unscrupulous with them. He had bid low in order to get the job, and then started doing it, and then started demanding more money, and was going to leave it half painted if they didn't fork over like an extra $100 or something like that. It's criminal. They were trying to figure out, what do we do with this? And they decided they were going to make it a learning opportunity for their kids. Gospel culture, learning to get the gospel. And so they sat down with the kids, and they told their kids, "This guy's stealing $100 from us. And we do things to Jesus all the time that annoy him, and he loves us and forgives us completely. And so we're going to write a check for $100 and we're going to make a card for him. And I'm picturing a little girl, you know, cutting out a card, drawing pictures on it of the family and of the painter and saying, you know, we love you more than money. God bless you. And sending it away because it's an opportunity to talk to the kids about forgiveness. It might be different. It was a $10,000 check. You know, looking for opportunities, you know, to, you know, Dan Allender talks about a bad example. He says, some of the most blasphemous words out of my mouth toward my children have been, why can't you try harder? Why can't you be like so-and-so? How come Travis was invited on that team and you weren't? Didn't you see how well-behaved Jennifer was at the wedding? You know, all those comparison things, putting the kids on a treadmill, saying, work harder, try harder, do better, be like them. I'll tell you instead about a story about a little girl named Callie. Callie came home from school telling her parents that a bunch of kids had made fun of her, and she was sad and she was scared, and she was asking if mom and dad could give her a ride to school instead. And the parents talked, and they acknowledged little Callie's feelings. She was a little girl, and they supported her in her sadness, but they also wanted to figure out how to bring the gospel into this to help little Callie fight that biggest battle of her life, which is to find her significance not in what she does, but what in Jesus did for her. And so they sat her down and said, you know, those kids sure are acting like you're not special. When they treat you like that, how do you feel? And you know, Callie's little eyes got all big, and you could see the tears welling up and streaming down her cheeks. And so they grabbed her, they hugged her, they comforted her. And then they said, so it sounds like on this hand, there are these kids who are saying that you're not special, you're little and you're dumb. And on the other hand is Jesus, who says that you are special and you are capable. And if he was picking a team, he'd pick you first. So now, which one of them do you want to believe? Who do you want to believe? Another story, a supermarket temper tantrum. And mom massively overreacts because she's embarrassed in front of all these people. And so later she sits her little girl down later that night and says, you know, Emmy, I'm sorry I got so angry with you at the grocery store today. I was concerned with some of your behaviors, which I should have been. But I was even more concerned with what all those other people in the grocery store would think about me. And I'm really sorry about that because Jesus approves of me completely because of what he did for me. And I don't need their approval. And I'm sorry that I was looking for that. And I'm sorry I took that out on you. Will you forgive me? You know, that's the gospel. When mom and dad can ask, can not only name their sin, name the real sin, the one underneath, that they were looking for approval, and then confess it to their kids and apologize. You know, is the kid going to be more or less open about their brokenness? Are they going to be more or less secure after that? They're going to be more. They're going to be confident. They're going to get the gospel, and they're going to start to see the difference that the gospel actually makes when it catches hold of your heart. Another little girl, six-year-old girl, was in a gifted education program, and she wasn't, you know, she would normally be picked up at a certain time to be taken to the gifted program and then be brought back, but several weeks in a row, the person hadn't picked her up, and so she sat in the other class the whole time, and she went and talked to her dad about it, and she was upset, and she was sad, and she was teary-eyed, and dad asked, well, have you talked to your teacher? And she's like, no, her eyes get big, terrified. Obviously, she's afraid of talking to the big grown-up. She's 6 years old. And so dad says, well, honey, you're wearing Jesus, and he makes you special and capable. Would you like me to go with you while you talk to your teacher? And that's what he did. He not only validated her concerns, but he reminded her of who she was in Jesus, that she was capable and valid, and he would enable her to do that. And then he went with her, lending his power as an adult to her to help her do what she needed to do so she could learn to live out the confidence of a daughter of God. And so they met with the teacher. Dad said, my daughter here has something she'd like to tell you. And then the teacher turned to the daughter. The daughter spills her heart, talks about how upset she is and all that's going on and how she hasn't been picked up and she doesn't know what to do about it. And then the teacher talks to the little girl and says, you know, I'm gonna call around, check with a few people. Something's gone wrong here, but we're going to make this right. And this week you're going to get picked up. You're going to get picked up every single week from here on out. It's going to be fine. And so thank you for sharing this with me. It's really helpful. And then teacher turns to the dad and says, thank you. Goodbye. He didn't have anything to say. It was hers to say. But he empowered her because it's a gospel culture. I think of another woman named Holly, not Hoppy, different Holly, who had three kids, I think, went on a trip. She had a trip to meet some old friends she needed. Honestly, she needed to confront them with some things. It was going to be a difficult trip. She didn't want to have to be on this trip. She didn't want to have to confront them, but she knew she needed to. And so, she goes on this trip, and her first night there, the phone rings. It's her husband. He's checking in. Hey, Holly, how you doing, hon? And Holly answers, I'm doing fine because I just opened my suitcase, and there was a card inside from Kara. That's their 10-year-old daughter. And she opened it up, and it says, dear Mom, I love you. I know this is a hard trip for you. I think it's neat that you care about your friends enough to try to talk to them. I know they might make fun of you. Just remember, Mom, Jesus is who makes you special. Yours truly, your daughter, Kara. Where do you think she learned that? How many times had Mom and Dad told her, Jesus is what makes you special, not what you do? There is nothing you could do that would make us love you less or God love you less. There is nothing you could do that would make God love you more or us love you more. It's Jesus who makes you special. And she had heard that so many times that she had so much strength and confidence in the gospel that she could sneak a card into her mom's suitcase to preach the gospel to her mommy. It's beautiful, Okay, so as a parent, if I were a parent, I'd be feeling pretty cruddy right now, having just seen the perfect parents, who actually are totally imperfect parents. They're just free in that because they're loved by Jesus and they know it. To have a gospel culture in your household means that you're going to have to believe the gospel for yourself, because you're going to feel guilt and shame at times when you're sinning. If you're using the gospel in daily life, if you're going to your child and asking their forgiveness and confessing to them that you were really concerned about what other people thought about you and you're embarrassed and you took it out on them and you're really sorry and that's not you believing the gospel. If you're doing this, if you're really forgiving your spouse, if you're confessing your sins to them and they're confessing to you and you don't want to forgive them and you're mad and you're using the gospel, you are going to need more and more gospel. You're not going to be the person sitting there saying, grace, 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 gospel, 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 all this gospel. Yeah, you're going to be so empty from pouring the gospel out and claiming it and believing it for yourself and doing really hard things, going to the teacher's conference and all this stuff. You're going to be coming to church just saying, oh, please, somebody, oh, dear God, just tell me you love me. Tell me that I don't have to perform, that Jesus performed for me. Remind me of that unremovable suit of forgiveness and righteousness. Remind me that I matter to you, God, and that I'm secure in you. Because I've seen the stuff that goes through parents' minds. I remember on Facebook, the Bad Mommy Bingo. Did y'all see that Bad Mommy Bingo? It's 5 across, 5 down. If you get 5, either diagonally or up or down, then you're a bad mommy. Use the TV as a babysitter. Picked up the kids wearing yoga pants with bedhead. Birthday party wasn't worthy of Pinterest. Failed to cherish every moment today. Talked on the phone when the kids were at the park. Forgot class picture day. Had Happy Meals for lunch. Threw away their artwork. Still haven't lost the baby fat. Hiding in the bathroom. All the things. What that tells me is, parents, you must feel massive guilt. And you need the gospel. You need to know that Jesus has your back. That he is happy with you now, and you do not need to be the perfect parent. It was the New Testament scholar William Hendrickson who said, remember, men, parenting is not difficult. It's impossible. You need Jesus. Yeah. Remember a mom who, stays up until 1 a.m. sewing her newborn's Halloween costume. And it's amazing. It's beautiful. I'm not going to criticize it. It's human creativity and all of that. But, if you're staying up until 1 a.m. sewing a newborn's Halloween costume, then are you really doing it for the newborn? Or are you doing it for me? It's like me posting cat pictures to Facebook. My cats hate that, especially when I dress them up. But, you know, we can make an idol of these things where I have to be the perfect cat owner. I have to be the perfect parent. I have to be the perfect dad, the perfect mom. And then, of course, what gets in the way of your idol of being the perfect parent is what? Your children. You'll be mad at them all the time because they're the ones that prove to you that you're not the perfect parent. But to believe the gospel, to know it, and to drink it deeply, you know, believing that. You know, when you remember that the Father loves your kids more than you do, it can bring a lot of security. You know, he says, talks in 1 Corinthians 7 about how the children of believers, even if just one parent believes, are righteous. They are saints, he says. They are holy. You know, I think of you know, how Jesus says that the angels always see my Father in heaven. The angels that specifically look over covenant children, children born in the church who are part of the church community. You know, American churches, we don't do a great job of anchoring our kids to the rock of Jesus. But that's all we've got. It's all that they've got. I'm going to conclude with one illustration. It's a story of Corey Hahn, 19-year-old kid. Corey Hahn had been an Orange County High School baseball legend. He was a former California Mr. Baseball, who, that's capital M, capital B, who led Modern Day to a 2010 championship. You know, he was a good batter, he was a good catcher, he was an amazingly good baseball player, and he had such energetic and he was such an energetic and gifted outfielder. He was in the Arizona State Sun Devils starting lineup the opening game of his freshman season. But in the first inning of his third game, Corey was sliding into second base in a double steal, and he heard a crack, and then he couldn't move. He had broken his neck so brutally that he actually heard it snap. Corey became a C5 quadriplegic. He was paralyzed from the chest down with limited use of his arms and little use of his hands. And after his initial hospitalization and rehabilitation, some thought that he'd just transfer to a school closer to home, live with his parents, but he wanted to go to college. And so he returned to the baseball team, and so his father, Dale, I mean, he was just on the sidelines, but his father, Dale, quit his job at the height of his career, 51 years of age, quit his job and returned with him to college to be his caretaker. Together, they journeyed into what seemed an impassable storm. Dale would wake up every morning in a hotel room and drive to the house that Corey shared with his teammates. Dale would then spend 90 minutes preparing Corey for the day, helping him bathe, brushing his teeth, feeding him, helping him get in dressed and get into his chair, and then he'd drive him to classes and rehabilitation before returning home. While Corey was in class, Dad was working out on a campus fitness center, trying to maintain the muscles and balance that would be required for all the positions from which he'd have to support and lift his 24-pound son. By the time Dale had finally helped Corey back into bed, it was often late, and both men were physically and emotionally exhausted. It was inspiring, but it was unsettling, because the only thing that was certain was the devotion that they had as they looked across the table into each other's eyes. Corey stuck in a chair, and Dale trying with all he had to give him wings. Fighting alongside Corey for 3 years without a day off in what onlookers call the ultimate love story had been his dad. Although Dale eventually moved out of the hotel into a less expensive staff apartment on campus, and his son moved into his own apartment, little else changed. Every morning, Dale is his son's alarm clock. He arrives at his apartment at 8 a.m. He opens the blinds. He turns the television on to ESPN Sports Center and begins preparations for the day. Every night, he still shows up to help his son into bed, even if it's 3 in the morning, even after a college party. At one point, Dad, it was so late, his dad was so tired, he got pulled over by a cop driving home because he was weaving so much out of exhaustion. That, friends, is an extraordinary dad. And if you're a Christian, you should be able to recognize that, because you have one of these as well. A Father in heaven who loves you so completely, there is nothing he will not sacrifice, even his own son. in order to love you. The love they long for, the love your children long for, they're going to find it on the rock, which is Jesus. The floods are going to come, Jesus says. Don't build your house on rules and on attempts to control, but build it on Jesus, on his complete love for you. You're the apple of your Father's eye. You are his delight. It is already finished. Unleash the gospel on your house, and your house, no matter how high the water comes, is going to stand. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that you are our dad, that you are wild about us, that you do give yourself to us. And I thank you, Lord, for your faithfulness. And I ask that you would help our parents to believe the gospel for themselves, and that you would help all of us to create a gospel culture in this church, Lord, that our kids might have life and might rise and stand and face the greatest floods in the world and the greatest battles of their life and come out on top, because they're going to come out with Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.
Friends, the Lord be with you.